It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone was like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says something like a recipe, bits and pieces and pieces and. I'm Jonathan Stuper Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And hey guys, I have a question for y'all.
Yeah?
Do y'all remember the fact that we have a 3D printer in the office?
I do. I sometimes look at it and think, what an expensive paperweight.
I was going to make the exact same joke.
Yeah.
Where is it now? It's around the corner somewhere, isn't it?
I think it's near the conference rooms.
Yeah, it's over by where our dear friend and coworker Robert Lamb hides out from the rest of us when he's in the office.
Does he actually hide over there? Is that where he is?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
That's his spy cave.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't have revealed this information.
Why didn't he just move his desk over there? I mean, he's got a lot of stuff. So, okay. All right. So we've got the Forbidden Zone in which Robert Lamb and the 3D printer have some sort of uneasy truce.
Well, I just wanted to highlight the fact that when we very first got our 3D printer, it was through some work relationships.
Yes.
We don't want to come off as ungrateful. Like, that was a cool thing. But at the very first, we were trying to figure out, okay, let's figure out how to use this thing,
like,
you know?
Yeah, 3D printer, gonna do some stuff with it.
And I was doing a lot of stuff with it. I installed software on my computer and I was making, you know, designs and, CAD designs.
The computer assisted design. Yeah, totally. Three-dimensional design. Yeah.
And it was fun for a while until, man, it was just really, really hard to get that thing to work.
It was a lot of work to use the 3D printer. I mean, it
and
takes,
like most well, jobs failed at some point yeah. along the line
and failed really spectacularly. And like the machine or the software didn't have any way of knowing when it had failed, so it would just continue to fail more and more hilariously.
Yeah, until you had something like John Carpenter's The Thing in place of whatever it was you were trying to create.
The plastic hairballs, I would call them.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and the reason for this is that it was a relatively inexpensive unit that was meant for home hobbyists, and all of the parts were not like finely tuned for the best possible use, and the software was all software that you had to go find. It didn't necessarily come with the machine.
Well, one piece of software came with it; others did not.
Yeah, and also just the fact that different factors can change the elements of the plastic that you're using, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you've got a lot more humidity or the temperature is different in the place where you are producing things, it may mean that you have to make some adjustments to the way a 3D printer typically works, the basic 3D printers, is it lays down a thin layer of plastic on a heated platform, and the platform mm-hmm. is heated in order to make sure that the plastic doesn't cool too quickly.
It stays tacky enough to accept another layer of plastic on top of it.
Right, and you do layer by layer by layer until the object you want to create has been made. And if you're talking about larger 3D printers, they might even have a heated chamber in order to keep an object from collapsing in on itself or making sure it maintains its structural integrity as you go through the print job. But there are a lot of things that could go wrong. I mean, if the plastic is not extruding at the proper rate, that's a problem. If the print head drags across any layer of plastic, it could completely dislodge everything.
I'm familiar with that problem.
If it scratches it in any way and creates an uneven surface for printing.
Yeah. So, because it's just following directions. Like, it's following a series of movements that it thinks it needs to do to complete a print job. 3D printers are not aware, generally speaking, of how a print job is going. So if something does go wrong, it just keeps on going wronger.
Which can be very funny.
It can be funny, but it can also be very frustrating if you're trying to print something for a specific purpose.
Yeah. So today, if you can't tell already, we're going to be doing a 3D printing update. We've done episodes on 3D printing before. We did one in October of 2015.
3D printing in medicine.
And one in August of 2014.
The art of 3D printing.
I think it was all about art, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was about replicating works of art and also creating new works of art with 3D printing.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. We did one about 3D printing in construction, I believe.
In May of 2014, called Print Your Dream Home. And then our fourth ever episode that we ever did was called 3D Printer Jam, When Tables Are Intellectual Property.
Yeah.
That's from March of 2013. And those are the episodes we've done that are entirely about 3D printing. Of course, we've mentioned it like a lot of times if you listen to the podcast, as an element of technology that researchers have been using in creating whatever it is that they're creating.
Exactly. And so today we're really focusing primarily on consumer 3D printers, stuff that would be in private hands, maybe for some small businesses. But additive manufacturing is clearly very important in lots of different industries. It's used in R&D and production on a professional level more than ever before. Like, it's 3D printing is enormous in various industries. It's great for prototyping. In fact, that's the primary use for 3D printers today.
Or has been, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is on the cusp of changing, but it has for the longest time been the main use for any 3D printer. The idea was that you would come up with a design for a product, maybe a change in a product line. You could then use a 3D printer to build a model of it and see if it would actually work in the real world, because sometimes a design that works on paper is not practical.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do it quickly. So if it didn't work, you could go back to the drawing board, make some changes, print those out, and try that. And it speeds up the prototyping process by several factors. And it also, because it's additive rather than subtractive, it's less wasteful than other methods of prototyping. So we've talked all about that extensively. And, of course,
though I wonder if the wastefulness thing will be challenged by the fact that you have to create like four failed attempts at something before it actually takes.
I think it depends upon the printer, too. Some printers may be less prone to print failures than others.
I know that. Yeah. I just mean if you've got one of these that has a lot of failed prints.
I still think it's probably faster than like carving away at some material so that you finally get at whatever it is you were aiming for, depending upon how you're carving. I mean, if you have a robot arm doing it, maybe.
Yeah. I was about to say, like, I am not personally a master whittler.
No, I've been known to whittle, but I mostly whittle toothpicks. I'm aiming for like a spoon, but I never get there. So toothpick it is. I figure, you know, you just say whatever you end up with, that's what you were aiming for.
Yeah.
And then it's a success every time. But we're also seeing the potential for using 3D printers in areas like in space exploration. There have been a lot of recent experiments. NASA has done several about how can we do 3D printing in a microgravity environment where
– including 3D printing of food.
Yep. So and that introduces challenges that, you know, here on Earth we just don't think about because we can rely on gravity to be a component of a 3D printer and hold stuff in place. But up in space, that's not necessarily a luxury that you have at your disposal. But – on that consumer side, we really want to look at what's going on because when we started this podcast a few years ago, 3D printing was one of those buzzwords that was really, really starting to hit full speed because I can tell you the first year I went to CES, which was 2008, mm-hmm. was the first time I had ever seen a 3D printer in person. I saw a MakerBot 3D printer. My co-host of Tech Stuff at the time, Chris Paulette, was with me. And he flipped out when he saw it. He knew immediately what it was he was looking at, whereas I did not. I had never encountered the 3D printer before. And when I found out, I was like, wow, that's a really cool idea. And obviously, those had been used in various industrial purposes for a while, but it hadn't really just started to dawn in the consumer realm, right? It just started to show up. By 2013, when we were really getting started with this show, it had gone beyond just hobbyists, like a very small group of hobbyists who were aware of it, and it entered into the general public consciousness. And that's really when things took off. And we wanted to kind of take bearings of where we are now based upon compared to where we were then. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's not like the graph just goes up and up and up and to the right.
No, I mean, I remember what things were like back when we started this show in 2013. So essentially, I guess the question I want to ask today is 3D printing another example of a bursting or recently burst tech enthusiasm bubble? Kind of like you might think of virtual reality in the 90s.
Yeah.
Not where the technology's, you know, never going anywhere, but at least for a while it has seriously squandered its public interest capital.
Right, because back in 2013, the narrative that was being shared was that 3D printers were going to be ubiquitous.
Yeah.
Everyone was going to have one.
One in every home.
And it was going to change the world.
Yeah, you could print anything you needed. If your chair broke, you could print a replacement for the part that broke. If you needed to end up printing out utensils, you could do that. Like you've got more people over than you have plates for. No problem. Print a few plates.
I think it was seen as a form of democratization and decentralization. In a way, doing for physical objects what the internet does for information.
Right. And so there's one question that we have in here. We were asking, did it really have that huge of an impact on people? And I would argue that in general, no, it has not. That's not to say that there aren't specific cases where it did have an enormous impact. There are.
Sure, but the kind of fear that was being expressed that was like, well, I'm a furniture designer, and will anyone ever buy my art again? My artistic, beautiful items again if they can just print them at home, which everyone will be able to do really soon.
Right. The fear that businesses like IKEA would disappear because anyone could just go take some photos of IKEA furniture, go home and 3D model them and then print them up in a day's time, and then you've got your own shelf with a weird Scandinavian name.
And looking at our legacy collection of these bizarre plastic hairballs, that's hilarious.
And especially,
like, that fear is just funny.
And even the successful print jobs, which are mostly just tchotchkes, right? There's
sure.
not – we didn't really succeed in printing anything of – real substance, nothing on a large scale.
The best thing I was able to print was a flat thing in the shape of the state of Tennessee, which is my home state.
I remember that we used to have a 3D printer before the one that we've got now. It was a smaller one. And I remember one of the things it printed, and I remember being blown away by it at the time, was it was like a little castle tower, kind of like a rook in a chess piece.
Yeah, like a rook. Right, yeah.
And it had windows in it. And if you look through the windows, you could see a spiral staircase on the inside of the chess piece.
Spiral staircase,
and
yeah.
There was and that just blew my mind. I was
me too.
It printed a spiral staircase on the inside of this thing. That's incredible.
I think maybe that first printer you had might have been a better one.
It was also a much smaller one. And it was not capable of printing in – two different colors of plastic simultaneously, but then you could argue neither was ours, though it was designed to do so. Yes, I would say that in large part it has failed to deliver. However, that being said, I do not want to be completely dismissive, because we are very much aware of cases where 3D printers, even consumer level 3D printers, have made a remarkable difference in people's lives.
Oh, yeah.
One example of that there are a couple different projects where people have open sourced the design and production of prosthetics for kids who might not otherwise be able to afford them.
Yeah, and I a whole bunch of high schoolers have done this, and it's amazing.
Now, these prosthetics that are designed, they're not intended to be permanent replacements. They tend to be sort of a temporary thing while a child is still growing, because obviously that's going to require new prosthetics over the course of the person's life. But they are something that allows a child to have a little more utility than they would otherwise. And so there's no denying that it's had an impact. And again, that was using consumer level 3D printers. But that's a special case, right? We are not in a future where everybody has their own 3D printer, where everyone is printing all the physical things they need.
Well, and it's not just that that hasn't happened yet, because you could still argue, I guess, that, well, maybe that's going to happen someday in the far future. It's just, you know, no one would have expected such a thing to happen so soon. But I'm interested in the fact that that used to be a much more strongly represented narrative in tech journalism and the popular consciousness than it is today. I don't hear people talking about that anymore.
Mm-hmm. It feels like the idea that Back to the Future Part 2 had, that we would have a fax machine in every room.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So that kind of ground level enthusiasm for 3D printers does not seem to be on the rise. And I also wanted to talk about some specific market trends, like just economic trends regarding 3D printing.
Yeah, because this can lead to evidence about whether or not that we're actually seeing a bubble, or if it's just, no, we're just on the journey to that destination. We just haven't reached it yet.
I think that 2012 was really the first big boom year in the stock market for companies that were offering commercial and consumer 3D printing technologies for sale. Stratasys was up 164% that year.
That's pretty significant growth.
3D Systems was up 270%.
Yeah.
Stratasys.
And their stocks would continue to rise.
Though Stratasys maintained its growth longer. So Stratasys, that, you know, they said, well, we do 3D printing solutions. So they were one of the big consumer 3D printing companies out there. According to NASDAQ, the Stratasys stock price peaked around $130 to $140 a share around the end of 2014. And it stayed high through the middle of 2015. but it has been falling ever since then. It's now close to about $20 a share.
Ooh, that's a pretty significant drop. Although I would need to look into it further to see, make sure like they didn't have any stock splits or anything, because that can affect the price as well. But,
oh yeah.
But assuming that there weren't any splits, then yeah, that's not a great story.
Again, also 3D Systems. I decided to look that up. The 3D printer manufacturer, 3D Systems, peaked closer to the beginning of 2014 at about $100. And has been mostly falling since then, is now at about $15.
Yeah, so if you look at market trends, it's looking pretty dire, right? That kind of leads to, or leans us closer to the conclusion that there was a bubble issue.
Mm-hmm. And you can also on the technology end, on the price end of the technology, kind of look at how it's been developing over that period of time, how low can you go?
Yeah.
How much can you make this available to people through price cuts?
And that affects, there are multiple effects that we would discuss here, right?
Sure.
Like you have the very low end side. Once you get the price down to a certain amount, yes, you've made it more accessible to a larger audience, but chances are, you know, the phrase "you get what you paid for" comes into play, right? So if you're paying a smaller amount for a 3D printer, chances are it's not at the quality of one of the really good ones, which means the experience the person has, even though they now have access to a 3D printer, is not necessarily a positive experience.
Yeah, and I think there's like a strange little curve happening in those prices over the past few years, wherein actually the prices have started to go up again for some of the like base unit models, and we'll talk about this. So at the beginning of this trend, back in 2012, the low end of consumer devices was a little bit above $1,000 a pop.
Mm-hmm.
The low end of commercial devices was about $10,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the end of 2013, we saw home units priced as low as 200.
Yeah.
That's obviously not a advancement in the technology in that time.
No,
that was leading to that kind of pricing.
I think what happens is this is armchair analysis here. I would argue that what happens is in 2012 and early 2013, you see this incredible interest in the concept of 3D printing. The media
and
gets
a 3D
involved.
Printer in every home.
Yeah, the media is involved. Investors are involved as they start to drive up the market value of various companies. Other companies say, "Hey, we can make some money getting into this business too.
We like money."
So you get a lot more companies making a lot more 3D printers along the entire range. You've got some that are making very expensive ones, and some making budget ones, trying to hit that consumer market, because once interest goes up super high, you can really profit off of that, right? People know what 3D printing is. They've heard the term. They are eager to get involved in this. And if you're not already part of the hobbyist scene, you may not be aware of what devices really are the best ones. You may just see, oh, hey, I've heard of 3D printing. This thing's on sale for $200.
Yeah.
That's an investment I feel comfortable making.
It's like your well-meaning uncle getting you a Nintendo for Christmas.
Yes.
And you just sort of going like, well,
Thanks, a PlayStation 3.
Man, I played so many hours of Super Machio Brothers. It was Ralph Macchio, but they never named the other one.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Fun times. Anyway, so to kind of look at some where the spread is right now, if you're looking at like what's considered the best of 3D printers in various categories, one of the resources I like is a site called 3dhubs.com. I've used it before, actually, because it also can put you in touch with people who run businesses where they print 3D objects for you.
Oh, cool.
You can send them the plans. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I use this a couple times with some costume pieces. I was able to send it because our printer, while it's awesome, I do really like our printer. It does definitely have some major problems that you got to babysit that thing, which is problematic because it takes so long to print. It was just not going to.
Also, I think I recall at the time the size of the build plate was an issue.
Yes, I needed something that was going to be larger, and I didn't want to have to break the build up into too many smaller parts and then glue it all together. I did have it printed in three parts because it was still pretty big, but I was able to use 3D Hubs to find someone, and they were, you know, they would oversee the build and make sure the quality was there. So I didn't have to worry about any of that. But 3D Hubs also has a section where they rate various 3D printers that are on the market, and they divide them up into categories that include enthusiast, plug-and-play, budget, and kits or DIY projects. So the costs have certainly come down over the last few years. I mean, when you look at when they were first on the market, you're talking in excess of $5,000. But again, by 2012, we were getting down to around $1,000. Today, if you want a really nice 3D printer, you're still paying more than $1,000. It's not like computers where you could say, well, I'm going to get a mid-range computer and that's going to be like a couple hundred bucks or $500 maybe on the higher end of mid-range. And it's not like that with 3D printers. You're still really getting what you pay for. So most of the reliable models they listed in the enthusiast category were around $1,500. Like the Maker Gear M2 was the top performing printer in the enthusiast category. And that was at $1,825. And also the enthusiast category, enthusiast makes it sound like, hey, I'm interested in 3D printing. It means more than that. Enthusiast means you are educated in the field. You are familiar with the way 3D printers work. You're familiar with modeling software. You have the...
Yeah, it's not a casual hobbyist.
Yeah, you have to be willing to go through that steep learning curve that a lot of these machines require. And this is one of them. They actually said, it is not easy to use. It's a great printer, but it is not intuitive. So it's one of those things that, you know, you start to make trades. Some of the other printers in that same category cost more than $2,000. A couple were like $2,200. When you went to the plug-and-play type, which simplifies matters, they make it a lot less complicated than some of the other models, you're still paying more than $1,000. Even in the budget level, the printers that they listed as good, reliable printers were $500 or more. So they didn't have anything below $500 that they actually considered to be a good 3D printer. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't sub-$500 3D printers out there. They just might not be very user-friendly or very effective. Now, it's kind of hard to say what does price mean when it comes to demand. Like, has the demand changed over time? It may very well be that 3D printers has never, as a product, has never really branched out beyond a relatively small hobbyist community. There, I'm sure it's made some advances beyond that, but I think at its core, we're still looking at a niche market. I don't think we're looking at a general market for many, many reasons. But you can't necessarily draw those conclusions just from the cost or the price of these products.
Well, there is partially the fact that some companies have, in fact, stopped selling.
Yeah.
Those poorly performing, cheap 3D printers. Like in January of 2016, 3D Systems announced that it was going to stop selling its consumer level 3D printers. The model that they're ditching is this industry unfavorite called Cube, which retailed for about $1,000, was generally reported to not work well, certainly not as well as competitors. The company is maintaining its Cube Pro, which is a manufacturing grade unit, which sells for about $3,000 and is better rated in the industry. But yeah, I think that this kind of thing is definitely indicative of the early consumer boom just being a hype bubble. Mm-hmm. And you know, companies have had to realize that the technology isn't just the hardware, it's the hardware and the software, and neither is cheap enough or easy enough to use currently to make 3D printing at home but possible for that casual hobbyist.
Yeah, I think for 3D printing to really be that compelling to a consumer, it has to be as dead simple as printing on paper. And the problem is it isn't. It's for multiple reasons, it isn't. And like you were saying, Lauren, it's the software and the hardware combined. There are complications on both ends that are barriers to entry for your average person. Mm-hmm. Someone who's willing to really put in the work, obviously they can do it. It's not like there's a bouncer outside the 3D printer world that says, I'm sorry, you don't make the cut. But it means a lot more effort. It's not something like even the plug and play printers that are on 3D hubs.com aren't necessarily completely intuitive and easy to use. They're less difficult to use than some of the other models.
Yeah, but to get away from the technology itself for a moment and look, you know, what is a market analyst's view of the overall, you know, market outlook for 3D printing companies? Mm-hmm. I did find an August 2014 CNBC article discussing this. It was talking about that year's collapse in value for 3D printing companies. And apparently in 2013, as we've been talking about 3D printing, it generated a lot of financial interest and a lot of investment. And in 2014, all that sort of started falling apart. Not for everybody, though. As I noted earlier, Stratasys was still doing well for most of 2014. But the article quotes a senior analyst at Canalys named Tim Shepard. And Shepard says, quote, "I think last year we saw stock prices of some of the leading 3D printing companies inflated beyond the level they should have been at based on hype and investors jumped on the bandwagon. But this is a market where there's a lot of misunderstanding. The reality is that it has huge potential to make a transformation to the way products are made and designed, but those will take a while to kick in."
Right.
And so, I think that makes a lot of sense.
So essentially saying people were getting excited
about a thing they didn't understand.
Yeah. Excited too early.
And there is, in fact, recent news that demonstrates this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's still investment in 3D printing companies. I was just reading news from today, or I think the past couple of days, about a 3D printing startup called Carbon that has received more than $220 million in funding with investors like BMW, Nikon, GE, and the Japanese company JSR. I think that's more on the industrial scale.
Sure.
Or manufacturing side.
It's on the production side of the manufacturing industry, and that's where a lot of 3D printing now seems like it's being focused. You know, car parts, machine parts, aerospace parts, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the hobby end, I think that's largely what people have been using the technology for. Yeah, I mean, maybe not car parts, but y'all, there's so much 3D printed jewelry on Etsy right now.
One of those pieces is currently on my wife's wrist.
Oh,
I'm sure it's beautiful.
It's nifty. She liked it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like, I could have printed that for you. It would have taken me.
Could
about,
you have?
Would have taken about 8 months.
Could you have? So yeah, I mean, I guess the question is how, if we're wanting to know how things have changed in 3D printing since we were first talking about it, you know, what, three and a half years ago. I think that over the past few years, various forms of additive manufacturing have proved useful in specific scenarios mm-hmm. where it's worth investing in expensive, high-quality technology.
Mm-hmm.
But at the consumer and hobbyist level, I think 3D printing does sort of remain about as much of a novelty as it was 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know what y'all would think about that. I mean, has it reached a valley in the hype cycle? And if so, when's it going to recover?
Well, you know, like looking at virtual reality, it's, you know, like that had a public heyday that was full of buzz about the incredible future.
I live through this.
And it was mainly focusing on these really like far-reaching entertainment applications. And that failed so spectacularly that it was followed by a couple really kind of dark decades where the technology was still in use, but very much so out of the public eye. You know, it was being used for psychological therapy, for astronaut training, stuff like that.
For virtual boy purposes.
For making yourself really nauseated. Yeah.
So, just kidding.
That's not even virtual reality, is it?
No. I mean, it was an attempt to try and create something approaching virtual reality. I definitely think that there are parallels. So with virtual reality, you know, you had all this hype, and the problem was when the public became aware of the actual state of the art of the technology at the time.
This ain't like I've been hearing on the news.
Exactly. Compared it to the hype, the two had some gaps mm-hmm. between them.
Chasms.
So much so that the term virtual reality, a lot of people decided that they weren't even going to use the term virtual reality to describe their work anymore because it was considered
tainted.
It had a stigma against it. So they started calling it virtual environments or other terminology to try and avoid VR. VR was considered toxic. And if you wanted to get funding for your projects, then you had to figure out something else. And it also meant that the people who were working in that field, they were starting to repurpose other equipment to act as VR equipment because they no longer had the money to build their own, you know, their own specific devices. So you had this huge amount of hype, and then you had the public kind of catch up to where the actual technology was. And then once those could not be reconciled, you saw a collapse. I think there's a really good parallel to be made with consumer 3D printers in that respect. Now, that's not saying that everyone was guilty of sharing this vision of a 3D printer in every home and we're all printing out tables and chairs and stuff like that. There were a lot of journalists who had a much more modest view about 3D printing, and they were talking about how they saw 3D printing playing more of an important role in small businesses, in production centers, where you might have a small business that prints on demand and builds objects on demand, which is kind of similar to what we have now, although I would argue that what we have now is much more modest than even this projection. But this projection doesn't take into account the idea of an industry being overhyped and this collapsing in on itself somewhat, right? If in fact we had had a more conservative buildup with 3D printing, so many puns, then perhaps we wouldn't have had the precipitous fall, and we would see more examples of this. But if you were to go to like 3dhubs.com and you wanted to have something printed, you could do that. And that's the kind of future that a lot of journalists I would follow were talking about. They said, yeah, I don't really think that this technology is appropriate for the average person to have hooked up to their PC because it has such a high demand on your time and attention to get to a point where you're really comfortable using it effectively, that it's outside the realm of most consumers. So, those people, I think, were being responsible. They were being more grounded and realistic. It was not enough to counteract the hype where everyone was saying, look at the potential for this stuff, and just equating that to being like right around the corner and we'll all have it at our fingertips all the time. There are some big problems that would need to be solved for us to fix this. Because you asked, are we in a valley? And if so, do we ever climb out of it? And if so, when?
I mean, I assume we will at some point. I'm just thinking, how long will it take?
I don't know that consumer 3D printers are ever going to be a huge product. I think
it's like not the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Like I could see it in, maybe the classic 20 to 40 years.
Yeah.
Maybe even longer than that.
When you get to a point where it truly is intuitive, it's easy to use the it's easy to load, it's easy to switch out materials, especially once we get to a point where the same device can print in multiple materials. We're seeing prototypes of that now on the professional side, nothing close to the consumer side.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But if we get to that, then maybe. But right now I would say that I think consumer 3D printers are pretty much consigned to being in the hobbyist realm and not going much further than that. So the challenge then is how many companies will either have to switch their strategies so that they're making more professional level materials and fewer consumer ones, and which ones are just going to completely go out of business because they have dedicated themselves to producing a product for which there is no sustainable market.
Yeah.
You know?
As we've been saying, it sounds like a lot of companies are in fact making that switch, and it's why we are continuing to read a lot of headlines, or not even headlines, but maybe stories that are incorporating 3D printing technology.
Yeah, there's still life in the hobbyist realm. So while I'm being kind of doom and gloom, it's not like the hobbyists are going away. It's not like they're less passionate about using 3D printers, and it's not like they're not pushing the envelope with what 3D printers are capable of doing. They are doing all of those things. It's just it's a smaller population than your general PC owner population.
Sure. On the professional level, though, the printers that are being produced are getting more detailed. I've seen a couple stories in the past couple months about using 3D printers to create thin plastic membranes, like for use in fuel cells or water treatment or food processing, that have very, very finely patterned surfaces to help with particle flow or even with ion flow. Or another example, these foam-like microstructures that are 3D printed that can retain their long-term stability and usability better than traditionally manufactured materials, meaning that like anything foamish, like insulating material, shock-absorbing stuff, flotation devices could be made to last longer without breaking or without needing to be replaced.
Yeah, that is something that we didn't really touch on, but 3D printing has really advanced our understanding of material science in many ways. And even given us the opportunity to play with some levels of microstructures down to a certain scale. It's hard to use the additive manufacturing, especially the traditional 3D printing technologies, for anything truly, truly tiny. For that, you got to go with a slightly different approach. It's still sometimes called 3D printing, but doesn't involve an extruder.
Yeah, right. But it's why like tissue printing hasn't really taken off yet, or hasn't really reached a level of usability yet. Because getting down to the cellular level is not
a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of progress in developing 3D printers that are capable of using different materials for one job. That was one I had mentioned. So for years, 3D printing has primarily been used for prototyping, but if you are able to print in multiple materials, that increases the utility of a printer and allows it to become a real manufacturing tool. So you could actually print a full product as opposed to like printing the shell or the casing or something.
Or a pizza.
Yeah. I mean, 3D printed food, it's a thing, but imagine being able to print out an entire circuit board. Everything, like you're able to print the substrate, and then you're able to print the actual circuitry and have it all designed that way.
Well, tell me, when will we print man?
Long pig? Well, we're going back to food. And, of course, there's been a lot of stories about 3D printing in medical applications, not just the ones about printing organs.
Not just for cannibalism, yeah.
Yeah, not just kidney. It's a good thing I have two of them, because I want seconds. The goal of printing organs is obviously one of those that we are striving for in medicine. But beyond that, we're talking about like the prosthetics. We're talking about some really interesting stuff. I read about a story from the Autonomous University of Puebla, which is actually the oldest university in Mexico. In fact, it's better known as the Benemérita Universidad Autónoma de Puebla. And my accent is terrible, I know. I apologize. But they've developed a 3D printed biomaterial that mimics bone and actually facilitates bone regeneration.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah, you often see this coming up in regenerative medicine and stuff like that, where they need a substrate to apply the material to. Yeah. And the substrate very often is a 3D printed one because they can custom make it to their specifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then also something that goes hand in hand with 3D printing technology and modeling is using scanners, being able to scan physical objects so that you can create the 3D virtual model and then print a replica of it. We're starting to see a lot more of those kind of entering that prosumer consumer market, which that removes a big barrier. Assuming it works well and assuming it has an intuitive interface, which are two big assumptions, I know, it does remove part of the barrier, which is building out those virtual models as a plan to send to a 3D printer. That is a skill that is not easy to attain. It requires a lot of practice, a lot of work. And if you have a scanner, then you can kind of do some shortcuts, right? If you can actually scan the thing you want to print, and it's able to create an accurate virtual replica, and you are able to send that to a printer, you avoid a lot of steps that otherwise would take you a very long time to do, especially if you had not had a lot of experience in computer-aided design.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that as well. And maybe that will increase the hobbyist population a little bit because you've removed one of the barriers there, but you still have other issues like just the idea that you have to sometimes babysit print jobs and make sure that everything's going all right and not turning into the plastic thread of doom the way it would here. So I would hope that we would get out of that valley. I would love to see 3D printing get a more like realistic standing and increase in popularity, but at a natural rate as opposed to a hyped rate where you do have this bubble burst. I think we did an episode, and I may be wrong about this. I know I've talked about it before, about how people tend to frame technologies as having a particular course where you've got the hype part of a product's existence, and then you've got the peak, and then you've got the decline, mm-hmm. and then eventually it levels out. And sometimes they level out higher up than other technologies do. And I remember actually looking at a map of one where it was really interesting because it put different technologies along that pathway, mm-hmm. saying like 3D printing at that time was still on the upward climb for hype. And other technologies that had been out for a bit, like 3D televisions, were on the downward slope.
Yeah.
Right? So, sometimes you could argue the hype is something that was not necessarily fostered, right? That it just kind of happens because people get excited about it and it just sort of has an organic build to its own. In other cases, it's very much a fostered approach where it has been a manufactured attempt to increase interest in something in order to sell more units. Mm-hmm. We've seen examples of both. I would argue 3D television falls into that second category a little more than the first.
Yeah.
I might be biased. I also covered 3D televisions for so many years that I'm a little bitter about it.
Yeah, no, I remember like every CES you would come back when I was on tech stuff and we would just sit there and you would be like, yep, there were some of those.
Yep, man, televisions have gotten so three-dimensional. It's weird.
Is anybody still trying to do that?
Not as much. Yeah. No, that was a real effort for not just television companies, but content companies like Sony that does both. That it was a real attempt to push that technology as a way of adding perceived value, because once you hit a certain resolution, it's really hard to convince people that you're getting that much more out of your device than you were before. Same thing is true with 3D printers. Another great example, 3D printers, you get to a certain point. Beyond that, your returns are so low. You're getting a reduced return. Like you might be paying $500 more for what appears to be a relatively subtle improvement in performance. Fewer and fewer people are willing to make that leap. Same thing is true in lots of different technologies, obviously. But this was kind of fun to look at. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, you can't help but feel maybe a little sad that the hype was overinflated things so quickly, because, you know, it makes it harder to make progress once that bubble bursts. Doesn't mean necessarily everything goes away. The internet didn't go away after the dot-com bubble burst, but man, things were messy for about 2 years. It was not an easy industry to work in. But that's a story for another time. So this was interesting, and Joe, thank you for suggesting it. It was Joe's idea that we revisit this particular topic. And so, guys, if you have any suggestions for future topics or a topic you would like us to revisit, why not write us? Let us know about it, because otherwise we won't know, and we'll just continue on with our merry little lives. You can get in touch with us by writing to us. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. Over at Twitter, we are fwthinking. Just search fwthinking in Facebook's handy-dandy search bar. Our little profile will pop up, and you can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.